I was a painter and decorator. I was a landscape gardener, a minicab driver, all just to make enough money to rehearse the band or to do the demo. I wrote and wrote and wrote. And that is the key to everything. I was never interested in being a clone of anyone, really. What's Bruce Springsteen done? Well, he's written a song like that. So I'd write a Bruce Springsteen song. If you remember the opening scene is I'm standing in the shower, but I'm looking terrified, you know. Freddie wants to meet you. And so I was taken upstairs, and Freddie was like, don't be ridiculous, darling. Spend the money. This is the only star of the show. You, the rest of them are all average. You are the one. I was young and so stupid, I had no idea how tough it was.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
Neville Keighley, Baloui Sam, welcome. Actually, you just mentioned it, this email that you sent me, and I was thinking earlier, I knew I'd met you, and I'm actually getting closer to where we must have met, because you mentioned Mark Booth, who was the managing director of MTV, who was a good friend of yours, and Christiana Backer, who was one of the presenters.
All of you. I knew all of you really well, but I had hair. And you know, it's very different when you're 30 years on or 40 years on and you've got no hair. So, I mean, you look still similar. I can look completely different. So it'll come back to you in a minute. But Mark Booth was one of my, he still is one of my best mates. I'm godfather to his children. And right at the beginning, I remember coming out to your Camden place all the time and going out in those days with Christiana and Mark, you know, four nights a week. So I remember we'd met loads, all those wonderful parties.
That's what I was going to say, because I knew MTV had some brilliant parties, didn't it, at the beginning?
The best.
Amazing.
Yes.
I know, they were completely wild. So
and if you remember,
one of those.
Steve Fagnoli as well was around, Prince's manager. He was in our gang, and we used to go out. And you were there. I remember there was one over in Westwood Studios, and there was one. Anyway, we don't want to hear about the parties, but we know each other.
We do. So listen, we're born in the same year as well. So we have this sort of growing up in Britain in common. You're from South London. I'm from Chelmsford, which is northeast of London. But, you know, London, the centre of London would have been, you know, the attraction for us.
Yeah,
when we were young. But I want to talk about the earlier times and just ask you, what sort of music did your parents listen to and when did your tastes diverge?
Well, funny enough, there was no music really in my house. My mother brought us up and she wasn't really very musical. But I went to boarding school where there was every kind of music and all the big boys and it was a mixed boarding school, but I remember the guy, everyone was into music because in those days, as you know, there was nothing else. I mean, it was music or nothing. And so you have quite a diverse taste, a lot of heavy rock and everyone had, you know, there was one guy I remember who was expelled for plugging his electric guitar into the chapel sound system in the middle of the night and the whole area listening to this blasting. No, so it was pretty full on music, but I was, you know, I mean, 71, 72, David Bowie was my thing, and then all the Roxy music and everything. But of course, I loved, there was so much of it. You know, if you think Jethro Tull, even the heavier stuff, the original Genesis, the, you know, I mean, everything, there was so much music, wasn't there?
I'll come to the music in a second, but I just want to ask you, because I know that both my brothers were sent to boarding school. One wanted to go, the other one was a sort of rebellious, had masses of fights in school, and I think my mum just wanted to get somewhere else. Did you feel actually that your parents had pushed you away? Because I've read a lot about young people when they go to boarding school, it sort of breaks the umbilical cord to the parents earlier than later.
Oh, it definitely does that. It definitely does. Once you send your kids to boarding school, they've got another agenda. I mean, even now, I see that with my friends who send their kids to boarding school. You are making a decision, and the kids are going to still love you and they're still going to come home all the time, because in those days we didn't come home all the time, but there you are making a decision and school becomes their life. Sorry, anyone listening who is thinking about, I mean, I haven't sent mine to boarding school, but I don't need to, you know, so, but you're absolutely right.
Also, parenting is different. I mean, you're a parent, you've got two young girls, I think.
Yeah.
And parenting is much different. Back then, I think parenting didn't really exist as a term, did it? You know, my father didn't know what school I went to. I mean, he didn't really have any contact to my father at all. Yeah. And it was quite a sort of odd thing today to think that that would happen. Were your parents very involved in your
life? My mother was. My father wasn't. You know, he left when I was three and my brother was a baby. But so it was my brother, my mother brought us up, and it was quite a lot for her to bring up two boys. I mean, remember, boys are always fighting, and in the 70s they were difficult. So I was sent to boarding school. My brother went, got a scholarship to Allains in South London. He was super clever. So he went on and did great academic things, and I just was on the rampage from the age of 10. Now, thinking about it, 10's very young, but I didn't think I was young at 10. I thought I had it under control. So, you know, probably I wouldn't send a kid to school at 10, but I went, you know, I loved it.
You mentioned Bowie and getting into Bowie, which is something that we, you know, I'm going to say of our age, but it's actually across these generations, actually. Yeah, yeah. But definitely of our age, that Bowie was the phenomena. And for me, he represented, you know, like Bowie was the alien, the other, and he sort of represented my route out of the life that I was in. Yeah. What was he for you?
Well, the same, because it's the first thing you hear. You see, if you think about it, we're the same age. So about 12, suddenly you hear, and you're aware of music. I mean, the first thing I heard was David Bowie. I mean, Starman. I mean, there were other things around me because the older kids, but this just jumped out. I remember Starman on the radio and thinking, this is just the most incredible thing I've ever heard. I mean, or been a part of. And it makes you dream, and it makes you go off and be in another world. And so then I was hooked. I had to, you know, eventually write songs and whatever. But you're absolutely right. But Bowie was very special time. And if you go back to kids a bit older than us, theirs was heavy rock, you know, and, you know, it's the thing that sparks you, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I mean, with Bowie, I mean, I remember I can, you know, recite practically all the lyrics about the first five albums.
Everything. Yeah.
Did you also look at who were making the records at that point? Or did
of course
that come
I did.
Later?
Of course I did. I knew everything about everyone. And that's why when I finally got to New York and started finally making my album properly again, remaking it from the first time, you know, I knew these people's inside leg measurement yes, I did, because it was so important. I wanted to know how he made his records and where he made them and what was influencing. I wanted to know everything. And like you, I knew every lyric up until Let's Dance. And then after Let's Dance, I think that, by that stage, I'd sort of met him. I had met him, and I was working with the people that he had been working with. So I don't, you know, I wasn't so interested in the next albums. It was, I had my own path, you know.
Now, was it Bowie that sort of inspired you to pick up a guitar and write songs, or to just, you know, just to sort of get into music at an early age?
I don't say it was actually Bowie. I mean, I learned the guitar with... it was a route, it was an escape. I don't know if it's an escape route. I wasn't going to do anything academic. I wanted to be theatrical, I wanted to be in show business. And I had a Beatles songbook, and I learned the guitar with the Beatles songbook. And I recommend that to any kid who wants to learn the guitar, get the Beatles, you know, songbook, and that'll teach you easily how to learn the guitar. You don't need to be clever, you know. And so I started with that. And I wasn't so interested in playing David Bowie's songs, because I didn't want to copy David Bowie. I wanted to be my own thing, you know. I was never interested in being a clone of anyone, really, you know, if that makes sense.
Yeah. When you were 18, you left school, and that must have been something like 77, that sort of the early punk era.
Yeah, 77, 78, I think, end of 70.
Well, did you also leave home at that point?
No, I never saw the point. I didn't have any money. I mean, the thing is, I lived in South London anyway. So, no, I didn't leave home until I was, you know, much later, because I then, you know, eventually started traveling and playing and touring and things like that. And my poor mother, you know, I always remember my mother gave up smoking and drinking the month I left home, which I always thought was... And I didn't realize until about a year later, she wasn't smoking, wasn't drinking. I was like, what the hell? And yes, I think that's probably quite telling, isn't it? No, I didn't leave home. No, I had no money. And of course, I left school, you know, armed with a load of songs. By this stage, I was going to record companies and A&R men with my guitar. I couldn't afford demos. And it wasn't working. So it took another 2 or 3 years afterwards before anyone started to listen seriously to me. No, I had no money. And it was really hard, actually, because everyone writes you off.
But that era is a very interesting era, because the late 70s and we go in and the early 80s, going from an era which had, okay, we had like the 3-day week where we had no power in the mid 70s, I think that was, or 73, 75. And then a bit later, there's you know, mass unemployment. There's then racism. There's misogyny, homophobia. You know, I mean, it has the whole works, but there is also group of subculture, which in a way went round all those things. Were you in that sort of
subculture? No, I was really bad at it. I mean, I was, it's sort of like, I was aware of it. I mean, I was a painter and decorator. I was a landscape gardener, a minicab driver, all just to make enough money to rehearse the band or to do the demo. I wasn't a passionate, sorry, Paul Weller, you know, or whatever. I wasn't angry. I had my own agenda. I sort of skirted round it, like you said. I mean, and I didn't, I mean, I wasn't from Birmingham, so I didn't dress up as a new romantic. I wasn't. I remember I didn't know. No, I just carried on. Solo artist called Neville Keithley writing nice songs, which of course is doomed, you know, absolutely doomed. You're never going to get anywhere, you know.
So when you're saying you're writing nice songs, what, when you went to the record companies, I mean, this is quite a long period, wasn't it? A period of about 4 years where you're really trying to make it. I just wondered what you learned in that period and what you learned from rejection.
Well, it toughened me up. You know, I mean, when I left school, I thought it would be 6 months I'd have a record deal, you know, and of course it was, if you know, my first record came out when I was about 5 years later, but it toughened me up. It made me go home and learn my skill. I had no choice. I mean, you sit there and you write from 8 a.m. until, you know, 1 a.m. and you know, because I was living at home. I was under a lot of pressure, you know, no money, blah, 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 odd jobs. So I tried to get my skill, sort my skill, learn songs. So I'd go to see publishers. They say, yeah, much better, Neville. You know, what are you talking about? And then I go home and get another appointment 6 months later with another one. It was soul destroying, but I was luckily, I was young and so stupid. I had no idea how tough it was, you know?
What did you specifically learn then? You said it hardened you up, but what did these rejections and also what you were doing, what did you really learn for life, do you think?
Well, you know, the thing is, the first thing is, it's really important, the innocence of youth. I mean, ignorance, innocence, I don't know what it was. I mean, I sat there and I went home, right, okay, what's Bruce Springsteen done? Well, he's written a song like that, so I'd write a Bruce Springsteen song. And what's Elton John done? So I'd write an Elton John song. I mean, I wrote and wrote and wrote, and that is the key to everything. It's the more you write, the better you get. And there's no way around that. Don't think about productions and don't, I never thought about productions or anything. I just thought, does the song work? Does it flow? It's all about the song. And I wrote them all on acoustic guitar. So they had to work because the melodies, if they weren't strong, they wouldn't stand out. And so, you know, Imagination I wrote when I was 19, you know, it didn't come out until I was 24, 25. So that gives you an idea. So, it's just about working. You can't do it on a Mac. I worked with a management company about 20 years ago, and you know, they'd get all these DVDs, you know, CDs would come in, and, you know, I wrote this song last week and I know it's a hit, you know, really? Because it doesn't work like that, does it?
What about Lose It To You? Because that was the first song you recorded, I think, which is actually, I just watched it this morning on YouTube. You can, the record's on there and you can.
I haven't heard it.
All right.
For 40 years. No, I the only reason I know about it is because someone added it to my Wikipedia about 6 months ago. I must listen to it. I'm saying it sounds pretty horrible, doesn't it?
Well, it's, I don't think so at all. I mean, I think it's identifiable, but it's not completely, it's not, I mean, I know it's under the name Neville Rowe, but it's not Baloui Sum, as, you know, we would get to know Baloui Sum, but it's definitely on the way. And I just wonder, because even with that, you know, you worked with people who were sort of, I would say,
Roland and Kurt.
Maybe not at the time. Yeah, Roland and Kurt.
Well, they weren't at my league at the time. They were in graduate, and they were, and they, you know, and they were with the same publishing company of mine, and they were groveling around like me. I mean, graduate, they had a couple of singles, I think, on Polydor. I don't want to offend any graduate fans. It certainly wasn't Tears for Fears, you know. But Manny was a great drummer, and Roland and Kurt were great. And they had the thing is, I got an it. Darren Hatch helped me produced it, and he had a connection in Bath. Because they were all from Bath, you see. So we went trundling off to Bath. I've completely forgotten all this, by the way. And David Lord produced it with Darren, and all the musos were down there, all played on it. I think they played on the demo for Imagination as well later on. But I switched off to music, remember, for 30 years. So it's all.
I mean, they were all musicians who were on the up.
Yes. You know, well, they weren't on the up then. They weren't Tears for Fears then. All right, I'm sorry to dampen your enthusiasm. They were like me, groveling around with great, great ideals, all thinking they were going to change the world, to coin a phrase. And but we hadn't actually got to that stage yet.
So what were your expectations at the time?
Change the world like them. But I mean, and of course, and you have this incredible confidence that, you know, you really are. This is it. Lose It to You was it, you know. And I probably felt I was more up than them at the time because I was recording a single and they weren't. So, but they were great guys. And I still see Kurt, once at Blue Moon, and Darren. And yeah, it was all part of the process.
Yeah, talking about that process, because to be honest, I mean, the chorus in that is brilliant. I mean, I actually really liked it. So I'm like, this is, you know, I heard it this morning. And I think it's because I had a different expectation, because I thought, okay, this must be like the first attempt, and it's the one where he's going, oh God, I don't, you know, this isn't what I want to do or want to be. But actually, you can really feel that there's,
I'm very flattered.
The chorus is really good.
I'm very flattered. Thank you. I'm going to have a listen. But the thing is that, but realistically, I wouldn't have had Roland, Kurt, Manny, Darren, David Lord had done the Corgis and had worked a lot with, Genesis, Peter Gabriel. I was working with good people. So I'm assuming that they lifted my song to their level.
Yeah, I'm also assuming that they also saw something in you, whether you say it today or not. They obviously saw something in you, otherwise they wouldn't have bothered. I mean, people don't bother when they don't believe in something at all. So
I don't think they were paid. They weren't paid. So, I mean, they didn't have any money. So they must have done it for the right reasons. Yeah.
When that record came out, what did you learn from it about your style, your look, the way you performed, the way you sung, that you could change?
Well, I don't think that I deliberately, I think I was back to writing, but the good thing was that like you just said, I think other people started doing demos with me and getting me studio time, and I was starting to move to the next level of people taking me a bit more seriously. I mean, I still looked like Neville Keithley, Neville Rowe. I still had curly, you know, normal hair, and I wasn't a rock and roll star, but I was, you know, I was completely unstoppable. You know, nothing would stop me. I would do anything to get to the next level. And so if there was an opportunity, I would take it. And this would probably leading towards the big moment when, I mean, I had another single out, I think called Wartime, that no one ever heard. But then Steve Elson, who was a good songwriter, is a great songwriter, Paul Harrison, the keyboard player from the Corgis, and started doing demos with these guys. And at the same time as if you want me to carry on talking, I'll tell you what happened. I had an aunt who lived in a cottage in the middle of nowhere in North Wales who was, bless her, she was a bit of an alcoholic. And so I'd go up there and do some work on her house occasionally. She was a very eccentric lady. And my brother and I would go up there and she'd pay us. Basically, she, you know, bunged us some money to do painting and, you know, she had some cash and whatever. And one day she said, well, you're pretty useless at doing what you're doing because you've been doing it for 3 years and nothing's happened. What do you need? And I said, well, I'm a solo artist. I need a band. Well, how much does a band cost? I said, I don't want to be in a band because I'd had auditioned loads of bands and they'd always gone wrong. So I said, well, I've got to pay them for the rehearsal time. I've got to pay them. And she wrote a check for like £500, which was a fortune in those days. You know, I was like, you could buy a car, go on holiday for 3 months and, you know, do up the house on that, couldn't you? But it was a fortune. So, and then, you know, at a later stage, she bung me some more money. So I came back to London. I knew what to do, put my band together and went out to try and get gigs. And the band sounded amazing. The songs had been honed. You say Lose It To You. This is a couple of years on. So you're talking about a lot of the songs that were on the first album. They were played out. Rehearsed every day for a month with this young band. The band looked amazing. And I had a whole load of gigs lined up. And the first problem was, the big problem was, I didn't have a name. So this brings me to the Bluey something. I was still Neville Keighley and everyone was like, you can't be Neville Keighley. It's a ridiculous name. Solo artist doesn't work. You're not a band, so you've got to come up with a name, Neville Rowe, you know. So it was just, I was 2 weeks away from the first gig, you know, in the Embassy Club. So it was the Bluey something band, but I never got the Blues Brothers was out and the Kinsman song Louie Louie was in it. And I mean, you know, I was clawing every direction and it was Bluey Song. That's the name. That's what happened. There's nothing. You know, the divine moment was I went on stage with my hair like this and froze at the first gig, which was at a place called Monkbury's in German Street. And so afterwards, everyone said, you know, that was terrible. You're terrible on stage. You've got no stage craft. You're the worst. You've got to do something. And
wait a minute. Who said that to you?
Everyone. I mean, most of the audience were friends. This is the worst gig we've ever been to. I just stood there. I froze. So at the same time as Blade Runner had just come out, and you know, it's very striking. It's common last, but you know, those days to have white hair was really strange. So I had a girlfriend, and she knew a hairdresser. And I sat there for 8 hours while they dyed my hair white. You know, it went yellow, it went green. Eventually, it came out white. My eyebrows, everything. And I went home and, you know, people don't recognize you. Just imagine there's no one with white hair in those days. I mean, Billy Idol had a sort of, but he wasn't really, you know, he was an American. It wasn't really in our zone. So I had white hair, a new name, and two or three shots of vodka. And I went on stage as Bluey Song, and that was it. And then, you know.
Who approached you with the Barrow Brothers, the ones that were looking after Duran Duran? Did you approach them or they approach you?
But at this stage, things are starting to sort of be a bit more, people are starting to be a bit more interesting. But the great thing was that the Embassy Club, we had the first gig and my manager at the time lived opposite a school somewhere in Hertfordshire. And we were all much younger and he was chummy with the sixth formers and he rented a coach and put a couple of cases of beer on the coach. And so for the first gig at the Embassy Club, there was a big bundle of kids outside. There was a crowd. So the record companies that we'd managed to get along, including, the guy who worked for the Barrow Brothers, not the actual Barrow Brothers at that stage, they couldn't get into the gig. You know, someone had to go out and get them in because there were so many people there was 100 kids there at the Embassy Club, only took 200 or something ridiculous. So there was a perception that it was time. You know, it was my window to get a record deal. And there were a couple of A&R men there. You know, some love it, some hate it. But I was off and running. And then, you know, within sort of 6 or 7 months, and then the Barrows were like, ooh, what's this? They came down and they liked the songs. And that was the next level, you know, next stage.
What did they promise you?
Well, they were very, very powerful at the time. I mean, they were managing Duran Duran. And to anyone listening to this, Duran Duran were the biggest band in the world. You know, they had number one albums in America, UK, all around the world. They were on their right at the top of their, they were on their way right up. And there was a tour coming up the following year, and their idea was to, you know, put me on support for the tour in the States. But it didn't happen because my record wasn't ready. My record turned out, my first attempt at the album was a disaster for lots of different reasons. So it wasn't ready, so it didn't happen. But they were very supportive. I mean, they were really supportive because they were song people. So Paul and Michael, they weren't interested in it. They were just like, get the songs right, you know?
That's really fascinating because, you know, Target Practice that came out wasn't really, you know, wasn't a success initially.
Yeah.
You weren't happy with the recordings that you were doing.
Yeah.
And I just wondered if you went through a phase of thinking, God, I've invested such a long period of my life, 500 quid from my aunt wasted. And here I am and it's not happening. So
I was in trouble. I was in trouble. And basically the manager had to go because he was a madman, bless him. I mean, you know, his intentions had been fantastic, but it wasn't working. I was spent a fortune with EMI, with Parlophone. Great Dave Ambrose, A&R man. They were so supportive. EMI were always fantastic, right? Liberos. And then I thought, right, I've got to do something. I'm on my last. So what had happened is this version of the Target Practice you heard had been mixed by Michael Barbiero and Steve Thompson in New York. And I'd gone over there and I said, look, I'm in real trouble. My album's not worked. I've spent 10 years getting here. It's rubbish. It's not what I wanted. And they said, well, I know what we could do. This is how it should sound. And it was just amazing. Suddenly I was with people who were positive, and I said, well, I've got to persuade EMI. So I came back to London, and that's when I put my persuading cap on to persuade Dave Ambrose to let me go to New York and record a song, a single. And that it was Imagination, but...
But that persuasion then was money. You had to get money out of them, or did
it was always about the budget. I mean, at this stage, they'd spent $500,000 by this stage on the album. It was rubbish. I mean, it was just not going anywhere. I mean, bits of it I've salvaged in the end and went back with Steve and Michael. We, you know, some people had been, no, some people I did myself. No, okay, yeah. So so what happened was Dave was like, all right, okay, but make sure it's a hit. So I said, of course it's going to be a hit, Dave. And I always remember the great thing, fax machines. This is a little story. It's absolutely true. In those days, fax machines were new. And I remember that Steve and I said, we've got to make it special, Steve, because, you know, we need an angle. So he said, well, I've met Carlos Alomar and he really wants to work on some stuff we're doing. And I said, OK, great, Carlos Alomar, my hero. But David's Bowie's guitarist and dream guy. And Carlos said, well, I've never worked with Bernard Edwards and Tony Thompson. Of course, I've known Niall for years, but they're in town and they would like to do something. We've never done something together. We've known each other all our lives, right? And so from Chic. So they said, I'll get Bernard and Tony. And I came back to London and said, listen, I've got, they were, Chic were pretty big, you know? I mean, and Tony and Tom, and, you know, they were pretty big at the time. And Carlos, so Dave said, all right, we'll make sure it's a hit. Send the budget over. And I always remember the fax came through. This is the funny bit of the story. The fax came through and it was $34,000. It came through to the publishers. So I remember tip-exing out a zero, whacking it off to EMI, all blurred. Do you remember faxes were blurred? $3,400. He said, fantastic. And it's good value too. So I got on the plane, went to New York, did Imagination and Walk Away on a Saturday afternoon, live vocals, got on the plane Sunday evening, came back to EMI Monday morning, said, there's your hit. But what a process. It had taken a long time.
What's amazing to me is, a number of things here. I want to start with Carlos, because Carlos Alomar was, his riff was Fame, wasn't it, as well? He was more Bowie.
I mean, all the way through. Here, you think, I mean, with Robert Fripp, with Heroes, everything. I mean, Carlos is there all the way through, from Young Americans all the way through.
which is, you know, and the connections, the sort of Bowie connection with you is sort of amazing, because it's like, you know, there's the childhood idol is Bowie, and then you're connecting again later on. And one thing that's really interesting there is that the idea that record companies at that point still had money, didn't they?
And it was a fortune. They were making fortunes. So the thing was, I was talking to someone the other day, you probably remember this. Basically, they bargained, it was about 100 grand a single. You didn't spend 100 grand, but you went in, it cost, studios were between 12 and 1,500 quid a day. Now, you know, it's 50 quid and a packet of crisps, isn't it? I mean, it's just a different world. You're right, they had a fortune, but I didn't chase David Bowie's people. It's just that they were an incredible musical entity, you know. And if I can just throw in, because I'm talking, but it wasn't well received that I'd gone to New York. It was, you know, but you're English, what are you doing in New York? You know, you should be making English records for English people. And I was they're so much more positive. They were so much more positive in New York. You know, I'd gone from all this negative, everything going wrong, to, wow, this is fantastic. Let's do this. Let's do that. And, you know, that was something that stayed with me for the rest of my career. You know, that New York.
One thing, you know, I loved working there. Your drive. I mean, it's everything you talk about shows immense drive in your life, like the commitment and drive of taking risks and doing things, it seems to be there all the way along. Have you ever sort of sat back and analysed, or even, you know, I've been to therapy a lot, and I've sort of seen where my drive came from. And it's actually, you know, we sort of identified it was that my father didn't show much interest in me, so I've sort of been trying to get his attention, is the idea in my life. That's where we honed it down to. Have you ever looked at something like that in terms of your own drive and where it may have came from?
Well, I never really thought about my father, because he was never around, and frankly, he seemed like a bit of a prat. I mean, I didn't meet him a couple of times later on when he was older, but then by that stage, I was a pop star, and I really wasn't interested. I had no, like, oh my God, my father. No, I was always driven, always having, but it's not a good idea to turn around and analyse too much what you're doing. Or, I mean, if I'd analysed where I was going, what I'm doing, crazy, headstrong, do every, you know what I mean? But you can do that when you're young, can't you? You can attack the world, you know?
Member Week is here at Lowe's. Don't miss your chance to get up to 40% off hundreds of items like paint, stain, tools, flooring, and more. Shop our exclusive deals happening in-store and online from May 8th through May 14th. Not a member? Join MyLowe's Pro Rewards for free today and get ready to save more. Lowe's, we help you save. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
But you did attack the world, didn't you? I mean, some people was the result of this was then some people, and this album, which then you came back with. And how did the record company react to the product that you actually presented them with?
They loved it. They loved it. I mean, the thing is, I was really lucky that EMI were very supportive. Polyphone, EMI were very supportive, and they loved the album. The big problem that they had was, and this is what we first started off when we were talking, as everything in the 70s and 80s was categorized. You were a new romantic, you were a rock band, I wasn't anything. I was a guy, a pretty middle-class guy who wasn't political, with white hair, who was English, who'd made a record in New York, and the marketing people at EMI had an appallingly bad time at trying to get it across. I mean, you know, there's no question that Imagination survived, and some people have both survived 40 years, but at the time, it was like, well, what's this? You know, I remember Radio 1, Capital would never play Imagination. Who's he think he is making a record with the Chic people? I mean, that was the direct on Monday morning. He's like, well, who's he think he is? You know, there was that rubbish. So Imagination and some people were both re-released. And it was Gary Davis who got Imagination away, because he was playing on Radio 1. Here we are. We've got a song called Imagination by a guy called Bluey Sum. Have a listen. Oh, he said, and halfway at the end, he said, that's good. I'll play it again. And he played it twice. And that's what broke Imagination. So, yeah.
That's fascinating because you're talking about radio there and radio had such an impact at that during that era. And we're already in the 80s in America. We're in the MTV era.
Yeah,
where
it was vital to me, you know. So
yeah, absolutely, and I think that was one of the most interesting choices was when you came to make a video for Imagination,
and yeah,
Storm Thorgerson. So was that your decision, or did that come from the record company?
My manager by this stage, I had an American manager, and I had Bill Kirby in England. But my manager, they were all very close to MTV, and the Barrows were very close to MTV. So I sort of did my naughty version of Imagination, which is the video. I went to Storm, Paul Barrow's idea, I think. But we went to Storm, who was a genius, you know, a nutty, but a genius. And so we want to do a 12-inch version. And this is what we want, the concept. And we're not stupid. I mean, we had MTV in the States involved the whole way through. They did a special on a video that they couldn't show. That's the irony. So they were involved right from the beginning, and we did a launch of the actual with MTV. So MTV News in New York, when in the States, was at the launch of the video that they couldn't show. because no one had really done that before. And the reason was, it was the programming. I knew that, if you remember, Steve, every club and bar in the world had these big screens that would come down. It was a no-brainer. If you wanted to be shown all night, every night, in every bar in the world, do something that was a bit risky. So that's what we did.
No, I remember that. I remember when seeing Michael Jackson's Billie Jean in a club in London, in a gay club in London, where they brought down the screens at midnight and showed this video. And they did it with Thriller. And we just stood there and watched it like it was completely normal.
And you're sort of like, wow. I mean, and the thing is, So that's what happened. And of course, you know, it completely is a massive dance hit all over the world. And, you know, still, meanwhile, you've got radio going, well, who does he think he is? Because, you know, it wasn't broken by Radio Imagination, you know. And of course, all the Europeans picked up on it long before England. That's what we did with the video. And then Storm did Some People with Storm, which was also, a commercial in the States.
Just going back to the other one, because you said, it was shown, wasn't it shown in Studio 54 as the first?
Yeah, the launch was Studio 54. And the thing about Studio 54, you know, it was still happening, Studio 54, but it wasn't like the days of, you know, everyone crawling around in the basement doing whatever. But it was still a good place to grab some attention. And so that I wasn't at the launch, but, MTV and everyone and all the record companies and it was a great place to launch it. And I just, I'd forgotten that, you see, until fairly recently as well. But it was all part of the whole risque thing. I should say, from the first minute I started doing this, I knew that America, sorry, UK, was far more important. So I would always, what about the Americans? I mean, I would, you know, I knew that Capital in LA was more important than, you know, I was a London-based act and I love London, but I knew that you had to get American.
I mean, you mentioned the Barrow brothers, the importance of their role in it, because they'd already had Girls on Film, hadn't they, with Duran Duran, I presume. Well, that was the forerunner, in essence, to the idea.
Absolutely, that's what Paul said. It's been really, it's shown in every club in the world. It's about, you know, so let's do the same with you, with Imagination, because Imagination worked like that. And Storm was the perfect director for that, because he was a genius, but barking mad, you know. And I had no idea really what was going on most of the time. I mean, I had loads of meetings and I got a feeling that we actually got some money out of Playboy for that video. I was thinking about it the other day, I think Playboy put up like $50,000 as well, so that they could show it exclusively at late night. So, I mean, we would take money from anyone, you know, we're not proud. I mean, it was an event. And of course it gave me a calling card, you know, the Imagination video.
It was so... Weirdly, I was talking to a friend from MTV the other day because of, you know, interviewing you. And I said to him, didn't we go around Storm Thorgerson's? And he said, yeah, I think you did an interview with him. So did he live? He lived in North London or in...
Yeah, that's right. He had a Barking Mad studio up there with...
Kentish Town or something. It was something Yeah. No, I did interview him. No, and he was absolutely nuts, but very, very clever. And, you know, his work is fascinating.
He's genius nuts. I mean, he you know, every sleeve of note and art campaign, you know, Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin, everything is Storm. If you look at his, what he did, I loved him. I thought he was great. And he was, but he was, you know, the record companies hated him. You know, he was like, no, I'm not doing that. No, you could piss off. You're not coming to the set. You know, I mean, he was ruthless and he was incredibly rude to everyone. But he was a fantastic guy. I liked him a lot.
Did you have a say in anything that was going on then? Or was he actually just ordering you around?
No, but, I mean, there was an element of that. But, it, you know, I mean, you have to imagine that I've got to this stage. I'm not going to let it go. I mean, I always had a say in everything. That's why maybe it hadn't gone according to plan a lot of the time. But no, I mean, I did. I knew what the basic, you know, concept of the video was. It was some of the things he made me do were a bit embarrassing. Like it was quite a big film set. And it was a Monday morning we started shooting. It was a long shoot, like 4 or 5 days. I said, right, get your clothes off then. I said, what? I said, you know, he said, you don't think that they're going to walk around naked and you're not. And then I'm looking around at all these people and it's my first really big shoot. And I'm like, you know, I'm freaking out. Anyway, I did what I was told. I got in the shower. So if you remember the opening scene is I'm standing in the shower. Well, I'm looking terrified, you know.
Well, I think you're looking away, actually.
I have to look away for obvious reasons, Steve.
From behind, yes.
Thank God, yes.
Yeah. Oh, dear. But, yeah. I mean, that's, you know, I think those times in your life are sort of very pivotal, and you may not even realise it at the time. Did you know you were at a pivotal moment?
Oh, yes. I knew every time, even though every day. I mean, I never took a minute off, you know. I mean, I was on the phone. I had a big bag of coins and everywhere I drove in London in those days, you drove everywhere. I'd stop and there would be a payphone. I'd be on the phone to America with my coins, you know. I'll call you back in 10 minutes then. I'd drive another, you know, round because you could drive around. And every moment was pivotal. I knew I had one chance. And everything went really, really well. I mean, you know, on that album and then Queen with Freddie Mercury when Freddie asked me to do the tour, obviously by this stage, EMI are really taking me seriously. And then...
How did he approach you?
Well, I had approached Queen, the band, not Freddie, at a manager director's conference. They were in a special VIP part of the hotel and I was... about 11 o'clock at night, and I said to the girl from the record company, a friend of mine, she was fantastic. I said, I've got to get on this tour. There was talk of a tour. I said, I've got to make friends with them. So anyway, I was barged into their room, and I always remember telling Roger and John, listen, you need some young blood on your tour, you know, if you do it. And we had a drink, it was a laugh. But how I got the tour was Montreux. And there was a big TV festival, and it was 86, and everyone and their auntie was there, and Queen were about to launch the Magic Tour, which in those days was the biggest thing ever. It was a stadium tour. It hadn't happened before. And I got summoned at the party afterwards. The managing director of EMI came down and said, Peter James came down and said, Freddie wants to meet you. And so I was taken upstairs, and then Freddie was like, this is the only star of the show. You, the rest of them are all average. You are the one. This is the one doing my tour. And the managing director's like, Freddie, we can't afford it. We can't. Don't be ridiculous, darling. Spend the money. So I got the tour.
That's fantastic. Yeah. I love it. But when you actually went on tour with them, you'd already had this massive preparation because you'd played small clubs at the beginning. You'd had a real band. Were you perceived as a
live act
or were you perceived as a video act? Because in a way you crossed that boundary of both, didn't you?
I think I was different from most of them because most 80s acts were video acts. They weren't live acts, if you think, except for the big ones like Duran and Tears and whatever. But I was very definitely a live act. I mean, I was on the road. I was touring, playing all the time. It was really important to me because I knew you couldn't crack America unless you were playing the whole time. So if you look now at a lot of the 80s acts, the great bands, ABCs and Heaven 17s and everything, they weren't playing live in the 80s. I mean, they were making great videos and amazing records, but they weren't. So I was out there. I was playing and I loved it, actually. That was the bit I really enjoyed. So I was, I had a band that I, you know, a great band. I mean, they were fantastic. So for me, it was easy to slot in. I was playing all the way through the summer anyway. And so when Queen gave me those dates, you know, it was easy.
Was that around the time you were also touring with Frankie Goes to Hollywood?
No, that was a year before. That was a mistake.
To me, that sounds like a marriage made in hell, to the extent of that would have been wild.
It was very wild. It was very wild. And also, I'm perceived by everyone in those days. I was perceived as being quite posh, and they were, you know, hooligans. I mean, you know, Holly is obviously now a lovely guy, but he was always a slightly more genteel than the rest of them. But the rest of them were animals. And I always remember the first few dates, like my band could outdrink them anyway. So that was the first thing. So we weren't wimps, and I just think that I'd been in America a lot, so there was a lot of MTV buzz around me. So they were like, "Well, who is this guy?" They didn't dive in and start. They'd done a tour before where they'd been really badly behaved, and no one would do press with them on this tour. So I got all the press. So it worked for me really well. So whenever we turned up in a town, I would do everything. They were very big by this stage. I mean, people don't have any concept of how big Frankie Goes to Hollywood were. I mean, Relax and Two Tribes, as you remember, are phenomenal, you know, but they were really phenomenal. So I grabbed their press. We got on really well.
They also had them. You know, when you think of Relax, they had that first, you know, band video as well. I was actually, there's this girl with really long blonde hair behind the bar, Ange, who was a mate of mine. And she's in that video. That was sort of her claim to fame at the time. And they also, you know, I don't want to say used it because that sounds like.
Well, they got their record deal on that, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. And it was, you know, and that video is incredible because it is like pushing the
it's on the tube. Do you remember?
And then they had to remake the video, didn't they, with sort of these strobe lights or whatever they're called. And
that original is just phenomenal.
It's absolutely brilliant. How did it feel in that period to you about where you were going to end up?
Well, at that stage, I was convinced and everything was going very well. And then I went to New York to do my second album, and I had a live band that consisted of Carlos Alomar, Carmine Rojas on bass, Jeff Dugmore, Guy Fletcher, you know, from Dire Straits, Chester Kamen. I was going to use the Borneo horns for brass, Robin Clark, and goodness knows who else on backing vocals. I had the most amazing lineup, and we recorded the album, and that was it. And it was, we came back to London, the record company were thrilled, and I was thrilled. And we're ready to go. And then it all started to go horribly, horribly wrong. Did the first video. Tour dates were all organized. America's organized. Europe's organized. And then it went wrong. What happened?
Went wrong? Yeah.
It's really straightforward. I mean, everything's slotted in. Radio One's playing it. It's climbing the charts. The record's released. And it's all to do with logistics in those days. There were rules about you could only release a couple of weeks before to radio before it went out on sale. And if you remember, it's just before it's the MTV time. It's the same time as I met Mark. We became chums. The record's due to be released on Monday, the whatever, and it wasn't in the stores. So Radio One pulled it. So it's suddenly all airplay stops, the single's dead. The Europeans are going, hang on, wait a minute, it's not a hit in the UK, it's downgraded. Americans go, right, it's downgraded. So It's Let It Be With You. It was, by this stage, it's top five in America dance. The video's on heavy rotation in the States. It's, everything's going according to plan. Boom, it wasn't there. The guy, the head of sales and distribution at EMI had gone on holiday, and there'd been a mess up with the dates of the records going to stores. I mean, you know, I know it sounds really basic, but that's what happened. Once the record, once it's pulled from Radio 1 in those days, that was it. It was over. It never came back. He never got it back. I'd struggled for the whole year. We released lots of singles, but radio, no, it's not going to happen. Blue Thumb's not happening. You know? So it was over.
And also, obviously, the 80s, it was, you know, music was changing and the society was changing.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it was 87, 88. I used to go to Shoom and the sort of the rave culture was coming.
Yeah. But I'm now, I've transformed into leather jacket and jeans. If you look at the second album, you know, it's live band. It's all live band, the second album. It's not so electronic, and even though the first one wasn't that electronic, but you know what I mean? It was not relying on, it was brass, it was rock guitar, it was much heavier. And so I'd moved, I'd developed. I mean, I was going to Shroom and all the clubs, and that's where London was, you know, I was doing all the same thing. So I wasn't, you know, silly. No, it had gone wrong. And, you know, it's the end of the 80s, and you're just about to get there and you haven't got there. Now, a lot of bands that we know now did get there. They just got there. Maybe a year earlier than me, they, if you think of all the bands that have survived, the big ones, you know, the obvious ones, the 80s bands, but I hadn't got there. And so the whole thing, you know, it just, everyone was very nice and we carried on, but, you know, it was over.
How did you deal? Because, you know, this is taking a bit later, sort of to the mid 90s, when you know, the end came, as it were.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a similar period with me. I'd come to Germany, run a TV channel, and then my career completely fell apart and I was over. And there was a process of the loss of fame, which was, even though I was nowhere near as successful as you, but I was recognizable at that point.
I remember
that loss. Yeah. That loss of fame was quite painful in a way. It was like a loss that you go through in life. There's some sort of grief involved where you get used to it slowly in an acceptance, and then you deal with it and then you move on. How was that for you?
Well, I knew it long before everyone else. So, I mean, I was like, this is not going according to plan, and I couldn't get tours, and I did an American tour in 1988, small club tour, but I should have been doing something much bigger. Then I was looking at the management, and then there was some bad management advice. And, you know, then I really, really fought to make a third album, which is, I think, a beautiful album that, you know, BMG Arista didn't even bother with. I don't know why they bothered making it, but we made it. And I released that. It's got a couple of great singles on it. But they didn't, you know, they didn't even bother. So, you know what? I thought, that's it. You know, I mean, that's it. Because by the time it's the 90s, and I didn't like the 90s. The 90s were, you know, they weren't fooling anyone to me. They were, you know, Britpop was really, yeah, okay. I mean, I've just lived through the 80s. I'm not interested, you know. So I thought it was best. I've jumped ahead a bit, but I thought it was best, rather than be groveling around. I've still lived in central London. I thought, just keep quiet. I still chatted to all my friends who were in the music industry, but I kept, you know, it was very humiliating. It's very annoying. It's very frustrating. There's the guy that did Imagination, you know, there's a lot of that. And
I mean, what's interesting about that? I mean, that's what I used to get. It's like, oh, it's MTV, you know, and of course, to them, I'm the identifiable figure, and they mean that in a positive way. But to you, it's like a memory of what's gone in a way.
Yeah.
And I was embarrassed. It is quite painful.
It is very painful. But you can't say anything or do anything. You just got to smile sweetly and go, oh, yeah, right. You know, you just reminded me of the fact it's gone wrong, you know. And, oh, I love that song, you know, oh, great. Or, you know, and in America, oh, so what happened? A lot of what's gone wrong? What's happened? Well, what's gone wrong is real life has gone wrong. And you know, I chose show business. If you choose show business, you're playing with fire, you know. And you know, I scratched around. You know, I think I made a single with, funnily enough, I made a single with Matt and Biff, who about a month before they started recording the Spice Girls. So I did a cover, a Korea song, Baby Let Me Love You, which is great. Actually, again, I hadn't heard that for 21 years. And then I thought, you know, this is 1995. This is crazy. What am I doing? Who am I kidding? You know, I'm not making any money. I've got to get on, go move on. So I kept quiet and let them all get on with it, you know.
So then you've had a long, you know, a long period after that. And just a couple of years ago, which I think would have been just slightly pre-COVID, you made a decision to actually
come out of
your shell.
Someone called me up. I mean, my kids didn't even know I was a singer. No one knew I was a singer. I mean, my friends knew I was Billy Sun, but I, you know, the first thing happened about 10 years ago, I lost a lot of weight and looked a lot better because, you know, you get to 45, 50, you know, you're just like, No, I got a phone call. I was on the beach in Croatia. I was actually in the water with someone rang and said, oh, do you fancy doing Let's Rock next year? You know, all 12 festivals. I said, yeah, okay. They said, well, we'll send you a contract. I said, well, what do I have to do? Don't worry, it's in the contract. Okay, fine. That was it. And I did it. And that was one of the big moments in my life as well, going back on stage for the first time in 25, 30 years. That was.
How surprised were you with the reaction that you got when you went back on stage?
I was completely surprised. I mean, the last gigs I did, you know, there was a confrontation between band and audience. When you're a young band, it's a lot of like, but going on to an audience that actually knew all the words and liked you, and they weren't throwing things at you or, you know, they were, it was incredible. A great band as well, because, you know, technically everything's so much better now. So I went on and I was completely shocked. It was a big moment in my life. And my kids were there like, that was nice. And but the big thing, Steve, and you'll know this because you've met everyone, right? And I haven't seen these people for 30 years. No one. I haven't seen any band for 30 years. And there was a lineup with 12 bands, all ages. You know, the ABCs, Nick Kershaw. I toured with Nick. You know, I mean, all people I'd known, you know, reasonably well. Some I'd known very well, Tony Hadley, whatever. And it was like, yesterday. Oh, hi, Neff. Yeah, I was like, well, hang on, aren't you going to ask me where I've been for 30 years? You know, it was like yesterday.
Yeah, there's a loyalty, isn't there? And there's, I mean, I'm finding that with the interviews that I do, that because there's a commonality that we've all experienced something of the same in the people of that era, and particularly for you as musicians who have been out there and been successful, you've had very similar experiences along the way. None of them have stayed right up the top.
They've all had a terrible time at some stage, you know?
And they know what it's like to be at the top, and they know what it's like when it's taken away. Yeah. And I think that's the beauty of it.
That was lovely.
It gives you more humanity to understand that.
That was lovely. And that didn't exist 40 years ago, let me tell you. There was none of that backstage at Wembley with Queen on stage. Like, you know, we were all competing. But there's no competing now. That's a very good point. There was no competing. Everyone was like, hi, how you doing? All right, blah, blah, blah. You know, I mean, it was nice. It's a very, very nice feeling to be around. A comradeship, you know. We've all been through the same war together. Like old soldiers. It was... yeah, it was great. It was very lovely, actually. And the people who run these, the Let's Rock, they're the biggest festivals in the UK. I mean, the retro ticket is bigger than anything now because people in their 40s and 50s plus can afford to go. I mean, and it was just great. I mean, really nice, you know. No one pissed backstage, that's for a start. none of that, you know.
Come on, you're all backstage taking tons of coke and going shitless, aren't you?
No, everyone's looking around. Everyone's like, you know, no, there's none of that happening. It's, excuse me, where's my, you know, do I still need a hairbrush? You know, that was. it was very civilized indeed, and all family, and I loved that, you know, because you know we have lived through it, and any young band that thinks they've seen it all. Yeah, right. You know, you try living in the 70s and 80s. You want to see what it's like? It was...
I just want to ask you finally, because that going on stage and having that experience again and then seeing that the audience know all your songs and sing along and they're with you still, which is, you know, a really fantastic moment. Has it inspired you to write new songs and to actually think about... Let's take this to another level. What will you do now?
Well, all my interviews when I was doing the festivals was, no, don't be ridiculous. I'm not doing that. You know, and then I was rummaging through moving and we were rummaging through boxes. And I realized I did demo an entire album in the mid 90s, early, you know, to do another album. So I have got some great, and I listened to songs, I thought, you know, because I was a songwriter, you know, and the songs sounded, I mean, now if I wrote a song, it'd be rubbish. But these songs I wrote 15, 20 years ago. And yeah, I have an album and it's fantastic, but I ain't doing it. Well, unless someone comes along and says, listen, I'm not going to go through what I went through in the past. If someone comes along and says, hey, I really want to work with you, we'll do a couple of songs, you know, and I would like to do that one day, but I'm not sweating just to prove a point, you know. But I'd like to do lots of live stuff.
My advice is don't be proud. Just do it, because, you know.
If someone turns up and says, I'll do it, I'll pay for it and whatever, and then I would do it. But, you know, I'm not going to go out like I did in the old days and go, come on, you can work with me. I know I can get people to work with me, but I don't want to, you know. We'll see what happens. I want to do live, more live, before everyone my age keels over, you know. We're the next, you know, while the Stones and all that lot are still going strong, there's hope.
That is such a brilliant note to end on. Neville, it's been an absolute pleasure to catch up. And I'm really pleased that you're doing so well and have such great stories to tell. And you're a little bit like me. You think back at the past, you talk about it, and then suddenly you think, oh, God, that happened. And then comes a new story. So thanks again. Good luck with the future. And really, your contribution has been immense in that era. And it was a pleasure for me to go back and to listen to the music again and just sort of take me back to another era, and that was fantastic in itself.
Thank you so much.